This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Did you go to the UVA football game yesterday?
I did.
Or maybe you just heard about it. Virginia played poorly at times, but managed to win in the end. Most of the 60,000 fans yelled and cheered and got a weak voice. The excitement that comes with winning a close game in overtime was there. But Virginia won the game not because of any particular strength, but because the opponent failed. Specifically, the Wyoming place kicker missed the not always so simple extra point. The easy kick, the one worth the fewest points in the game, was off center. Game over. Let the celebration begin. Except for a few hundred in the stadium, particularly the Wyoming kicker. He fell to the ground in anguish at letting his team down. A few players from both sides tried to console him, trying to get him to stand up and walk off. It seemed to take some effect, but he finally let a teammate help him to the sidelines. He stopped a few times, slamming his helmet to the ground, kneeling down again and again, obviously suffering from the self-inflicted wound. One or two more fellow players patted him on the back to let him know it was okay. They were with him too. But I watched the kicker walk from one end of the field to the other, and not one adult, no coach, no staff member, walked up to thank him for his effort, briefly grieve with him, remind him there would be future chances to be the hero. This young man was ignored by his coaches when he needed them the most. I hope he can forgive them, since they don't appear to forgive him. And here we are, Sunday after the first home football game. What is today, the 10th? The 10th of September. Welcome, everyone, to the WNRN wake-up call, regardless of which number on the dial you're listening to. 919, 1031 in Richmond, the Lexington 95.9 crowd, the folks in Harrisonburg and Lynchburg and wherever else we're taking over the state. Interesting topic today with a great guest. Thank you for coming in. Jim Hensley. Jim, how are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I'm always thankful to those who give up beautiful Sundays like this. It's one thing when you come in because it's rainy and yucky and, you know, whatever plans you had got sent away. But as we'll get into within the hour, you're a busy man.
I am.
And it's even more thankful for you to take time to come in here. Jim Hensley, the Charlottesville Albemarle Public Defender. Not the only one, right? Aren't there? There are others in your office?
I am the chief defender in the office, and we have seven attorneys altogether.
And you represent the Charlottesville Albemarle only section?
Only Charlottesville and Albemarle, not the surrounding counties.
So like we have the Thomas Jefferson Planning District, which covers Greene and Nelson, and I think there's seven different counties along with the city. You're just Charlottesville Albemarle.
That's correct. And for example, we have we're part of the 16th Judicial Circuit. That it does include some of the counties you mentioned, Madison, Greene, Orange, Louisa, over into Fluvanna and down to Goochland. and even as far up as Culpeper, but we do not represent indigent defendants in any of those places except for Charlottesville and Albemarle County.
But hopefully, you know, we're not turning off folks in the other listening areas, because this is a topic, while Jim's going to speak about certainly his current job working in the Charlottesville-Albemarle office, the topic itself of the legal system and public defenders all around, but especially in the state of Virginia, this covers a much wider area, so hopefully you'll stay tuned, and you're always welcome to, call us, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, as we talk about that. And you should call us, because it is Listener Appreciation Weekend here. There's some unclaimed premiums from the last fundraiser, prizes that were never picked up, and they're all going out the door this weekend. And we've got one this hour as well. And so one of our phone callers will get a prize. We'll try to make it nice and fair by maybe giving it to the first one who calls with a question or comment on the topic at hand. Don't just dial us up. Tell me you want some prize. Michael's out there, though. And anybody can win. If you made a pledge during the spring fundraiser, you get a special gift tacked on as well. So it is Listener Appreciation Weekend, and there's prizes for all shows all through the rest of Sunday. So we are here with Jim Hensley talking about the Public Defender's Office. Jim, where'd you go to school? How'd you end up as a public defender? You know, those sort of basic questions. Let us in on your expertise.
Well, I went to law school right here in Charlottesville at University of Virginia, and I end up staying in Charlottesville, as many people like to do if they're able, after they've gone to the University of Virginia. I graduated in 1976, so I've been a lawyer for 30 years. First 15 years of my practice was here in Charlottesville. I was a member of a private law firm, and I did some criminal work as well as civil litigation, the general practice. And then in 1991, I had an opportunity to go to Lynchburg, where I started the public defender office in Lynchburg. And that was a career shift for me.
When was that?
1991.
Because we're going to get a little later to when the Charlottesville office started, so I'm trying to lay some ground here.
Okay.
1991, you went to Lynchburg to to start the public defender's office.
That's right. And I stayed in Lynchburg for 7 years, from 1991 to 1998. And then I was chosen to come back to Charlottesville to start the new office here, which did open in 1998. And I think one of the reasons that I was selected for this job was that I had been a lawyer in Charlottesville for 15 years before I started as a public defender in Lynchburg. So I had the experience of starting a public defender office combined with the experience of knowing the local criminal justice system and the local legal community here in Charlottesville.
Why pick the public defender as a career move? Because certainly, you know, I think it's going to come up multiple times during the hour. There's no money to be made as a state employee, right?
Well, it's a low-paid job. There's no question about that. But it's I felt at the time that I made the change in my career, and I still feel that it's an important public service, and there are a lot of rewards to being in public service. One of the other things that helped me make that decision was that I really enjoyed criminal law generally, and I especially enjoyed working with the indigent defendants that I was representing before I became a public defender. These are people that are in very serious trouble in their lives, and a good lawyer, a good advocate standing by their side can make a huge difference, and it's there's a lot of reward in that.
But, you know, your mother, I'm assuming, wanted you to be a doctor or a lawyer because those were good-paying jobs, they were stable jobs, etc. Did you let her down?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what she would have thought. She had passed on by the time I became a public defender, but I think she would have appreciated the decision that I made to go into an aspect of law practice that was public service.
All right. Let me ask this question, because I think that aside from the money that goes with it and that perception about why someone would take what most people assume to be a high-paying job and taking the societal good aspect of it over the money, is that public opinion. I think to a lot of people, the public defender, and I think I might even be using your phrase here, are the second string. They're devoted is one thing, and having the great desire to help the people who most need the hope, but aren't they getting the second string player?
Well, let me clarify one thing. You are using my phrase, but I was not using that to describe who we really are. I was using that term, second string, to describe who people often think we are. And that is a problem, as you indicate. People often think that public defenders or court-appointed lawyers are the second string. And there's somewhat of a stigma attached to the fact that if you can't pay for the services of a lawyer, the services you must be getting for free are second rate. And we struggle against that all the time with our clients, because they realize, or at least they believe, that if they had the money to pay a really good lawyer, they'd do better. I don't think that's true, but that's the perception that they have. And that perception certainly does carry over into the general public.
Now, just early on, by the way, we're talking with Jim Hensley, the Charlottesville Albemarle head public defender, about public defenders and the legal system, et cetera, here on the Wake Up Call. You mentioned that Lynchburg started their public defender's office in 1991, and Charlottesville started one in 1998. Isn't this a statewide issue? I mean, why are two different cities very close to each other, have 7 years between them? Isn't the public defender's office everywhere in our state?
No, and I think that's a good point for people to understand. In Virginia, we have two ways of providing services to indigent defendants. One is public defender offices. The other is court-appointed lawyers, who are private lawyers who take low-paying court-appointed cases as part of their practice. So we have a dual system. We do not have a statewide public defender system. Now, as far as how the system expands, it is very much a political issue. We have now public defender offices that cover about 60% of the population of the state, which means that 40% of the people in the state are not served by public defender offices. In the case of Lynchburg, the local community there decided that they wanted to have a public defender office for whatever reason, and they contacted their local legislators, and the bill went through the legislature, was passed, and the office was opened. At that time, when the system was expanding an office or two every year or two, the idea of having a public defender office was fairly uncontroversial. But coming up to Charlottesville, it was a different story, because the community here decided that a public defender office would better serve the people than the court-appointed system. And they asked the local delegate, who at that time was Mitch Van Yeres, to take a bill to Richmond to have a public defender office in Charlottesville. And that bill passed the legislature four times and was vetoed four times by the then-governor, George Allen. So it took 5 years to get a public defender office in Charlottesville, and this was the first time that having a public defender office was at all controversial.
Did Governor Allen veto any other public defender offices?
No. Of course, after he vetoed the Charlottesville office the first time, nobody really understood what he was doing, and I don't think he ever made it clear what he was doing. So there wasn't any move to put other public defender offices on the table, because it seemed like Governor Allen was having some problem with public defender offices.
So he never said that it was a budget problem, or I can't even think of what an excuse might be, and that's not meant to be a slam on Governor Allen, who provides plenty of those for himself. But he never said, I'm vetoing it because of this?
Well, he made some statements, and they were aimed at the budget impact of a public defender office, but they were not, if I could say this, it wasn't good analysis, because he took the cost of the public defender office, including the startup cost for the first year, and he said this would be too expensive. Well, it still wouldn't have been too expensive in my view, in most people's view. Public defender offices are for the most part cost efficient compared with court-appointed attorneys. But in any event, it's certainly wrong to look at, as Governor Allen did, only the first-year cost, because when you open an office, you've got to have, you know, buy computers and put furniture in and pay the initial startup costs, and when you amortize those over time, they turn out to be fairly insignificant.
So we still have two separate groups, right? We still have a public defender's office that represents what percentage of the state?
At this point, roughly 60% of the population.
Okay. And so that leaves another 40% that are represented by court-appointed attorneys.
That's right.
Why do other states have dual systems like this? Why is Virginia having a problem going all one way or all the other, having public defender's office represent everyone or only court-appointed attorneys represent everyone? Does each side have an advantage?
Well, I think that...
And I guess that's hard to ask. You're coming at that from a particular viewpoint, but you are the expert in the room.
I would say that the public defender office definitely has an advantage, but before I discuss that, let me go to the first question you asked, which is, why is Virginia doing it half one way and half another way? And what's the experience in other states? I think most states have a statewide system. If they choose to have a public defender system, it's almost always, as far as I'm aware, a statewide system. Or if they don't have a public defender system, then they have court-appointed lawyers, and that's statewide. So why did we end up with this mishmash or this mix of methods of providing the indigent defense? I think it's the history of Virginia. It's a traditional way of going about things. The public defender system started as a pilot program in 1972. And that pilot program had three offices, Roanoke, Stanton, and Virginia Beach. And over the years since then, the pilot was successful, and the program has expanded to where it is today. But it certainly hasn't expanded to be a statewide program. Back in 1989, I think it was, the first Virginia Commission on the Future of the Justice System recommended a statewide system. This is when Chief Justice Carrico was the head of our judicial system. And here just recently, there's a commission to study the 21st century criminal justice system and where we're going. And they have also recommended, at least preliminarily, that we have a statewide public defender system. So the people in the business are the people in the know, the people in the court system, and the people who have studied this say we should have a statewide system. But the political process is not yet convinced, and that's where we have to see what will develop in the future.
All right, 11:20 here on the Wake Up Call, as we talk with Jim Hensley, the Charlottesville Albemarle Public Defender. Feel free to dial us up, ask some questions, make some comments if you choose. Michael's out there to patch you through. Jim and I are in the studio to sound smart in our replies. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. I know it's a beautiful day, but you can call in anyway. The markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley, partly cloudy today, highs 80 to 85. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows 55 to 60. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs 70 to 75. It's clear across the listening area. 66 in the Valley, 75 in Lynchburg, 82 in Richmond, 75 right here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And today's programming on WNRN also being brought to you with the support of Blue Ridge Graphics at the corner of Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. All right, I see the phone ringing. Michael will get that, and in which case I will I'll ask Jim a simple question. You talked about Governor Allen and the fact that we're sort of 50-50 here in the state for court-appointed versus public defenders. How is Governor Kane going to handle things?
Well, we'll have to see. Obviously, Governor Kane came in for this past legislative session, but he did not have the responsibility of preparing the governor's budget. That was left to Governor Warner as the outgoing executive. So we're looking forward with great anticipation to what Governor Kane will be doing this year. And certainly we have reason to hope for some progress. Governor Kane is a lawyer. He is a practicing lawyer, and he has handled court-appointed cases. He has handled serious criminal matters, and I think he has a real good understanding of the system.
But wasn't Governor Allen one as well?
Governor Allen indeed was a lawyer, but I was practicing in Charlottesville when Governor Allen was practicing in Charlottesville, and I very rarely saw him in court, and I very much doubt that he had a great deal of criminal experience. Certainly, I'm aware that he had, if he had any, it was a great deal less experience in the criminal justice system than Governor Kane has. I might add that Governor Kane's wife, Ann Holton, is a former juvenile court judge, and she as well certainly is very, very aware of the problems of indigent defense and very sensitive, and I would hope very supportive of any efforts that Governor Kane might make to improve the system.
It's a little push from home.
Yes.
As well as someone I'm sure he considers professional. Our caller didn't want to go on the air, but the question, Jim, what's the big difference between a public defender that we've been talking about and a private defender?
Well, let me say, let's use the terminology court-appointed lawyer and public defender. And it's sometimes...
Well, let's not limit it to those two, because there's a third branch that we're overlooking altogether, right, is the people who don't, who have enough money to pay for what they need.
All
correct?
Right. Is it, retained counsel.
Retained counsel. Or
right.
Those are the three options if I'm to get in trouble?
That's right. You can hire your own lawyer, which would be a private lawyer, I guess, retained counsel, and you could have an appointed lawyer, court-appointed lawyer, who would be a private lawyer who's taking an indigent case, and you could have a public defender. So what's the difference between the three? Well, a public defender is in an office. A public defender is a state employee, and in many respects, our public defender offices are similar to prosecutor offices. We are full-time criminal justice professionals, and we have specialized training and experience in criminal law. We have specialized support staff, and we operate on an ongoing basis. We have an office that the more senior attorneys can provide supervision and mentoring to the less experienced attorneys. So it's a systematic approach based on a specialization in criminal cases. So let's move from there to the court-appointed lawyers. A court-appointed lawyer is usually not somebody who does criminal law full-time. It may be a person who has a good bit of experience in criminal law, but they are in general practice or usually small small offices, sometimes solo practitioners, but they don't have the support that a public defender attorney would have because they don't work in a full-time office that's devoted exclusively to criminal law. Now, the third group would be retained counsel, and of course, retained counsel would be any lawyer that if you had the funds to pay the fee that you could retain to represent you in a criminal case. Now, interestingly, a few years ago, the Virginia State Crime Commission did a study comparing public defenders, court-appointed lawyers, and private retained counsel. And in that study, they found that the results in criminal cases, as measured by outcomes, generally sentencing, and they had a lot of data that went into this study, that the results were comparable between public defenders and private retained counsel, and that the results were poorer for court-appointed counsel.
So if I had my own attorney that I paid, I don't know, $300 an hour, I'm effectively going to get the same result as if you were for me, but if I was too poor and the court gave me a lawyer, I'm more likely to go to jail for a longer period of time.
That's what the study showed. And, of course, obviously it's a study based on statewide data, and it's generalizations. Anybody can get an outstanding court-appointed lawyer, and anybody can get a poor retained lawyer. But the data overall statewide indicate that public defenders and private lawyers are comparable and that court-appointed counsel generally have poorer results.
All right. I got a phone call coming in, so let me take a second and do this little bit of underwriting. Today's program on WNRN brought to you by Five Guys Burgers and Fries, Seville Reader's Choice for Burgers. For 4 years running, Five Guys serves America's standard fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and open until 10 Fridays and Saturdays. That's Five Guys Burgers and Fries behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, in the Hollymead Town Center, and now in the downtown mall here in Charlottesville. On the web, it's fiveguys.com. That's FIVEguys.com. All right, Jim, are you ready? No. Michael, come in here and help real quick with the headphones. Laura, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hang on 1 second. Laura, where are you calling from?
Lynchburg.
From Lynchburg. Well, thank you so much. We'd love to have the Lynchburg callers. Jim, are you set?
Yes.
All right, Laura, fire away with your question or comment.
I have a question in terms of the sort of the state's approach to compensating the attorneys, both the public defenders and the prosecutors. I'm a former legal aid attorney, but I wondered what the disparity was in pay between prosecutors and public defenders, and if this reflects any orientation on the state's from the state's perspective as to who deserves the higher compensated defense.
Ooh, you brought up the whole second part of the show. Good going. No. Good going. You're bringing us right to it. But that's a big topic, so I'm gonna let you hang up, and we're gonna jump right into that.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
All right, Laura. Jim, Laura has brought up a big point that's made a lot of news recently. It's been in the newspapers. There've been some editorials on it. I'll let you take it. The difference in pay between the two sides of the legal system employed by the state government.
Well, it is a big issue, Rick. I think it's fair to look at public defenders and prosecutors as being the opposite sides of the same coin. As I described a minute ago, we both have full-time criminal justice professionals. We have an office that's geared to the criminal law function. We have people with different levels of experience, and there seems to be, on the face of it, very little reason, if any, to treat public defenders different from prosecutors. But the fact is, in Virginia, that we do that. Statewide, prosecutors are paid 24% more than public defenders. Now, I'm not sure I have.
So you get $10 an hour, they get $12.50.
That's right. at all levels. And, I mean, this goes for the chief public defenders, the chief prosecutors. This goes for the lawyers who are assistants in the offices. This goes for support staff. In Charlottesville, as recently as last year, there were secretaries in the Albemarle County Prosecutor's Office who were making more than assistant public defenders who were lawyers going into court day in and day out. And I don't at all mean to take away from the contribution that the administrative staff make to both of our offices, but it just seems unfair that an administrative assistant in a prosecutor's office is paid more than a person who's gone to law school and has come into this public service, low-paying job with a huge debt from law school. And so, I mean, these are the realities of the situation. But statewide, it is a discrepancy of 24%.
We are talking with Jim Hensley, the public defender, head public defender for the Charlottesville Albemarle office, about public defenders and the legal system and the effects of pay in both is what we moved on to now. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. If you want to use the toll-free line, like Laura, calling from Lynchburg, feel free.
Can I add a little bit to that last answer that I gave in response to the question? The caller wants to know, why is this? And as I say, it's hard for me to know, but I think that one part of the explanation has got to be the political process. And everybody knows that law and order issues get attention in the legislature, get attention from the governor, and we also have to recognize that the people that we represent, the people who are accused of crimes and are unable to afford to pay their own lawyer, are not people who have a big voice in the legislature. We had a bill in this past session to make a small step toward closing the gap in pay between prosecutors and public defenders. And this bill asked the legislature to appropriate enough money to pay public defenders 7% more than they're currently being paid. So this would have been, as I say, a small step toward closing a 24% gap, but it got nowhere in the legislature and it failed. So we need to keep working on that. But I think in the long run, one of the things that we all need to realize is that public defenders, as well as court-appointed lawyers, serve a very important function that benefits the community in ways that people are not so much aware of. They see prosecutors putting people in jail, and they think that makes the community safer, and perhaps it does. Again, I'm not saying anything negative about prosecutors, but when public defenders represent indigent defendants, and when we have a case where the defendant is found guilty, and through our sentencing advocacy, we are able to come up with a good plan for an offender, an appropriate sentence that's long enough to provide adequate punishment, but not so long as to cost the taxpayers unnecessary money for a lengthy prison sentence, then we're actually accomplishing something that benefits the individual offender as well as the wider community.
Well, but aren't many, and maybe I'm stereotyping, aren't many of the members of the Virginia legislature attorneys?
It was true at one time, but certainly that is a trend that's changing. There are fewer and fewer lawyers in the legislature. But let me clarify something here. The lawyers in the legislature tend to be on the Courts of Justice Committee, either the Senate Courts of Justice or House Courts of Justice. And the legislation that would make improvements in our system goes first to those committees. And because there are many lawyers on those committees, most of our proposals end up being passed out of those committees. So they're not the problem. The lawyers aren't the problem in the legislature, or at least most of them are not the problem. But the problem is that the bills cost money, and when they get referred from Courts of Justice Committee to the Appropriation and Finance Committees, that's where they die. And there are very, very few lawyers on the Appropriation and Finance Committees, and it's a big job for us to try to educate them about the need and the importance of improving funding of indigent defense.
Now, we're talking about funding. We're talking about the pay, the difference in pay between the public defender side versus the Commonwealth attorney side, the prosecuting side. Virginia is the lowest state, right? They're ranked 50th in pay towards their public defender, court-appointed attorney, the indigent representational side, correct?
That is correct, but let me clarify. I don't know that anybody has compared public defender salaries because we're full-time state employees. But where Virginia is 50th in the nation is the amount of money that's paid to a court-appointed lawyer who is a private lawyer taking court-appointed cases on a case-by-case basis.
Who qualifies as indigent, and which attorneys have to represent them?
I don't know what the standards of indigency are, but the process is this. If you're arrested, you're brought before a judge as soon as possible, and in what's called an initial appearance in court, the judge asks you, first of all, do you want to have a lawyer? And if you say, yes, I do, then the judge asks you if you can afford to hire your own lawyer or would you like to have a court-appointed lawyer. At that point, if you say, I don't have enough money to pay a lawyer, the court will examine your financial situation to determine if you're eligible for court-appointed counsel. And as I said before, I don't know exactly what those standards are, but they're administered by the court, not by my office or not by the court-appointed lawyers who get these cases. So there is a filtering mechanism that the court administers to see who's eligible.
All right, 11:38 here on the Wake Up Call. Feel free to dial us up, 979-0919. Somebody on the line now, but the toll-free line's open, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We're here with Jim Hensley talking about public defenders and the legal system.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, new Charlottesville school superintendent discusses her own ups and downs in the interview hot seat. Two local families have painful memories of September 11, 2001. They share their stories with The Hook. And Janice Jaquith wants to know why the issue of a possible Twin Towers cover-up is such an untouchable discussion. The Hook, by your side, every week. And let's take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. For campus, town, or mountain trails, you can choose from all kinds of brands like Patagonia, Mountain Hardware, and The North Face for outerwear and over 170 styles of footwear. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville, at Wintergreen, and in Richmond, and at BRMS.com. All right, let's take our call from Brad. Hey, Brad.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
Doing well, man.
Great. Listen, I just tuned in, so I hope I didn't miss it, but I was wondering if Mr. Hensley could address the case of Gideon versus Wainwright and how he feels that changed, or if it did change, what it means to be an American vis-a-vis representation under the law.
Ooh-hoo-hoo. More good questions. Everybody's just got this ESP thing flying around. All right, Brad, keep listening. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right, Jim.
All right. Well, Gideon versus Wainwright is a 1963 United States Supreme Court decision, and it's I think most people are familiar with the name of the case. It's the case that established the principle that if the government is going to attempt to put you in jail, that at the very least you have a right to counsel. And, of course, to have a meaningful right to counsel, it means that you have to have counsel provided to you at state expense if you are unable to afford a lawyer. And this is the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Certainly, Gideon versus Wainwright was a revolutionary case. At the time, the government in some places did provide court-appointed counsel and did provide court-appointed counsel in capital cases everywhere. But from 1963 forward, after that decision was announced, the states have been forced. Some states are willing, some are more willing than others, but basically states were forced to put in place some kind of system that would give poor people who couldn't afford a lawyer in criminal cases the chance to have a lawyer at state expense. So the public defender system in Virginia and in other states is certainly an outgrowth of that decision. How states organize the indigent defense function, as we've talked about earlier in the show, varies from state to state. And in our state, it ended up being kind of a mixed system, part public defenders and part court-appointed lawyers. But what it really said was, getting back to the issue of how revolutionary this case was, I think it recognized that it's fundamental to our system of justice that we have balance. I think that's what the case really stands for. If you're going to have the government with all its resources bringing charges and prosecuting somebody, attempting to put them in jail or prison, that fundamentally it's a fair thing for us to do to balance the system, to provide a level playing field, if you will. And that decision made it mandatory. You have to have a lawyer on your side if the government's coming after you with all their resources on their side.
By the way, Brad, if you missed the first part of the program, www.cvillepodcast.com. Typically, the program is up on the board within a couple hours after the show ends. www.cvillepodcast.com for the full hour with Jim Hingley here, the Charlottesville Albemarle Public Defender. Jim, you know, you're talking about Gideon v. Wainwright. Aren't most people's views of the good guys and the prosecuting attorney's office like sort of the law and order thing? I mean, you just don't see, and you touched on it earlier, you know, the money differential is that, you know, typically you're wasting a lot of time and effort on people who should go to jail anyway. And the only reason that they get off is because you point out some technicality.
Well, that's wasting a lot of time and effort. That's an interesting way of putting it, and I think you're right. A lot of people see it that way. But let me divide this into two parts. First of all, it's not wasting a lot of time and effort to determine who is actually guilty. And I'm referring to something that we're all aware of, or certainly much more aware of now. There have been innocent people who have been convicted. And the cost to our community is enormous when you have somebody who's innocent who is convicted.
Both financially and emotionally.
Financially and emotionally, and in terms of public safety. If you have convicted an innocent person, you know that the person who committed the crime is still at large in the community. And there's a fairly well-known case out of North Carolina where a rapist was committed a crime, and an innocent person was convicted and went to jail for a decade. And during the time that the innocent person was in jail, the rapist was still in the community committing more crimes. So determining reliably and fairly who's guilty and who's innocent is not really a waste of time, and it does, in some respect, contribute to public safety because you've got to be concerned that you have the right perpetrator. That's the first part. The second part is sentencing, and I touched on this earlier. Yes, if you're guilty, the case is not over yet. There has to be good sentencing advocacy, and there has to be a good sentence that's good for the community in terms of punishment and is good for the offender in terms of rehabilitation, and is ultimately good for the community because most offenders don't serve life sentences. Most offenders come back into our community, and what we do in the public defender office is we try to develop a proposal for sentencing that's going to let these people, when they come back, be productive citizens, and that, again, is a public safety issue, and it's certainly a cost issue as well.
All right. I got a few more questions on that, but we'll take our call from Ann in Lynchburg. Jim, you're still very popular in Lynchburg, it seems. Ann, how are you?
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if Mr. Henry had ever tried any capital murder crime and what that experience was like, and did he win?
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Capital murder crimes.
Well, yes, I have. I've had four capital murder cases in my career, and they were all during the time I was a public defender, either in Lynchburg or now in Charlottesville. I'm very, very happy to say that everybody that I represented has ended up with either a life sentence or less than a life sentence, and nobody received a death sentence. It's a these cases are, they're just enormously complicated from a legal standpoint, and they're enormously draining from an emotional standpoint. It's hard to explain what it's like if you haven't been there, but it's one of the most difficult things that any defense lawyer does, I think, is representing somebody who's facing a death sentence.
A quick follow-up to that. Has representing someone on a capital case changed your viewpoint of the death penalty in any way, or had some effect on your viewpoint of Virginia's role in the death penalty?
Well, I think the death penalty might be the subject of another hour's discussion.
I understand, and I've done several on that. Yeah. I'm just curious as to whether having a more of an insider's viewpoint.
I would have to say that I don't believe that it changed my opinion. I think one of the problems that we have in Virginia with the death penalty, and it's just one, I'm not getting into a full discussion here, but one of the problems is that that the system is unbalanced. And so as a lawyer in the system, I tried as hard as I could, and I was successful in providing the best advocacy that I could in trying to level the playing field, because when prosecutors come after you in death penalty cases, there's no holds barred. So,
all right, well, we'll move away from that. So no calling up about the number of days for allowed for clues and things like that. You can't be working Virginia over on that today with Jim. Let's get back to defenders and prosecutors being equal partners and paid efficiently, similarly. I read something, I don't know if it was in your article or another article that I came across, local Commonwealth Attorney Jim Camblos said that he disagrees with equal pay because the prosecutors accept everyone that comes to them and half to provide the burden of proof. So I took that to mean that their job is a little more difficult, having to provide the burden of proof, and they need more money because they have to try all cases.
Well, Jim's wrong on that first point. Prosecutors are not obligated by law to take all cases. There's many prosecutors in Virginia who have refused to take cases from time to time because of workload pressures, and they I'll give you two examples, Bill Petty in Lynchburg and Bob Humphreys in Virginia Beach. Both of those former prosecutors are now judges on the Virginia Court of Appeals. So it's incorrect to say that prosecutors have to take all cases. Now, they do take all cases here in Charlottesville and in Albemarle County, and they do that because they have a sense of public responsibility, and that part of what Jim said is true. I agree with that, but it doesn't mean that the law requires them to take all cases. Now, let's move to the second part. Does it make sense that because the prosecutors have to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that they should be paid more for that effort when you're defending a person? And I don't really see the logic in that statement. We're on opposite sides of the courtroom, but we're both interested in seeing that justice is done. The prosecutor doesn't want to get a conviction unless the evidence is truly there beyond a reasonable doubt. And the
you would hope
that's the principle that they adhere to, and the defense lawyer wants to be ethical and professional and do the best job for the client that can be done to give the client the opportunity to have a fair trial. I guess what I'm saying is that both the prosecutor and the public defender are most interested in seeing that there is a fair trial. And so the burden of proof is just one aspect of a fair trial. Why should somebody be paid more who's working to have a fair trial than another person who has the same objective, the defense lawyer, who wants to see that the defendant gets a fair trial?
11:52 here on the wake-up call as we wind down our interview today with Jim Hensley, public defender at the Charlottesville Albemarle office. Dial us up if you have a question here in the last few minutes or a comment, 979-0919, toll-free 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Take a moment and thank Underwriter 45Fix. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor, from kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding. It's 45Fix.com. Immediate no-obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And don't be going anywhere when we finish today, folks, because George Bell is here for Les Temps Purdue. The best of the 80s and 90s alternative. No Chaka Khan, no Mariah Carey, no of the artist formerly known as Prince. But you will hear the Pet Shop Boys, Husker Du, and The Mission, and requests are always welcome. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. And George, I must say that I'm surprised that you look so poorly on fashion people like Prince. I'm sure that's why you're not playing any of his music. All right, Jim, we touched a little bit on this in the Gideon Wainwright case. One of the things in there, one of my understanding of the statutes in there, is the reasonable caseload. And I think that I read somewhere that the 2005 General Assembly removed the reasonable caseload statute for the public defender's office. Is that correct?
Well, that is correct. The if I could just give a detail or two here, the indigent defense function in Virginia is now supervised by a commission. It's called the Indigent Defense Commission, and under
are you
the
president of that or leader of that in some way?
No. I'm actually the president of the Virginia Indigent Defense Coalition, and there is some confusion, unfortunately, and we're trying to look at changing our name there to avoid that confusion. But the coalition is a grassroots coalition of citizens and lawyers and lawyer organizations trying to get change in indigent defense. But going back to the commission is actually a state agency. It's a governing body of indigent defense in Virginia, and they were just set up in 2004. So this is something very new on the scene. And in the statute in 2004 was a requirement that the Indigent Defense Commission set caseload standards for public defenders, and then that was taken out of the statute in 2005. I'm not sure the reason why, but caseload standards are part of the equation when it comes to providing quality indigent defense, and it doesn't help to have a professional public defender's office, or it doesn't help as much to have a professional well-organized and well-functioning public defender office if they're given too many cases, if the caseload is overwhelming and you can't do a good job for the people you are representing. So caseload standards are what we need in order to regulate the workload, in order to make it possible for public defenders to do a quality job for their clients.
I'm curious, you know, we talk about the reasonable caseload. How many cases do you, and I'm assuming that if you're the head, you've got time, part of your time comes to paperwork and overseeing, because you mentioned the younger people on staff. How many cases do you have going at one time? And sort of put that into context.
Well, it's a hard answer to give, but you're correct. As the chief public defender in Charlottesville, I have administrative responsibilities, and then, of course, I have supervision responsibility for the less experienced attorneys. The number of cases that I have is generally less than the caseload of other attorneys in my office, but I generally tend to have more serious cases. So when you talk about absolute numbers, you have to think a little bit in terms of the relative weight of the cases. More serious cases take more time. But certainly, overall in our office, it's not unusual for an attorney to carry as many as 150 cases open at one time, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Good grief.
It's a lot. It's overwhelming. And we did a study, and we applied national caseload standards, the accepted national caseload standards. We don't have state of Virginia standards, but a nationally accepted standard for workload to the system as a whole. And we found that in the system as a whole in Virginia, public defender offices were representing about 50% more people than would be appropriate under accepted national standards.
All right, we're finishing up our time here with Jim Hensley from the Charlottesville Albemarle Public Defender's Office. And you're listening to WNRN Charlottesville on WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg. Jim, last question or two. Have there ever been any cases out there when you were like, so glad that I'm not doing that one here in the office? And the one that comes to mind, and again, I'm not trying to bring up any phone calls. I don't have any time for any more phone calls on this. Save them for the next time we get into this topic. The Sisk case, Alston and Sisk, and obviously Alston, I think his family was certainly wealthy enough, and he got one of the more well-known Northern Virginia lawyers. But have you ever just gone, golly days, thank you so much for leaving us out of that? You don't have to reply to that particular case, but...
Well, that's an interesting case, and it's certainly one that people are familiar with. Yes, I'm glad that I didn't have that case. It was a tough case, and the lawyer who had it, John Swirling, a privately retained lawyer, did an excellent job. An interesting footnote to that case, they ran out of money, or at least they decided not to spend any money, more money on the appeal, and guess what? The public defender office has that case on appeal. Not our local office, but we have a small statewide appellate defender office, and they're handling that case on appeal.
Goodness. And that's, you know, I read the paper on a regular basis, and I didn't know that. Anything that you're looking forward to over the next year or two?
Well, right now I'm looking forward very much to working in this next session of the legislature and with the governor's office. I'm a member of a work group right now with the office of the governor and the attorney general, and we're trying to bring forward a comprehensive proposal for criminal justice system improvements. In fact, I have a meeting on Tuesday in Richmond for that. So getting back to what you said earlier about Governor Kane, I have a great deal of hope that he's going to be somebody who will advocate for indigent defense. So that's what I'm really looking forward to right now, making things better.
Thank you so much for coming in today. I appreciate your hour with us. I hope we had lots of good calls today. People just leading me through the show by the leash. They knew what I was going to ask next. And good luck. I think even though I watch a lot of Law and Order, I think that the Public Defender's Office is very important.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
George Bell up next, boys and girls. See you next week.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Catherine Greiner. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.